My name is Jeremy. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm coming through okay, right? I'm at the mercy of some hotel Wi-Fi. So if you start hearing some choppy robot voice, just frantically wave your arms and I'll try to make something happen. I just hope it doesn't cut out during my epic punchlines of all my jokes. You know? But I'm really happy to be here. Thank you so much, Phil. I really appreciate the opportunity. And I really love Alcoholics Anonymous. I really do. And so if there's anything that comes through as far as what I'm saying, there's going to be a lot of words, 50 minutes actually worth of words. But what I hope actually comes through is the love that I really have for AA. That's what I really want to transmit. You know, I don't really just want to say a bunch of words. So I hope it comes through, because I really love it. And my sobriety date is November 22nd, 2009. And I was 19 years old when I got sober. So, 31 now. And I mean, when I say I grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous, I mean, I grew up here, you know, literally speaking. I was 19 years old physically, you know, 12, 13 on a good day emotionally. And so I just, this is where I learned how to be a human being and a man, you know, is here in AA. And so I owe my whole life to this place, you know? And I don't ever want to forget that. And speaking is an opportunity to remind myself of that and hear myself say that, you know? Because the way it seems to go for me is, I don't get distant when things are going, poorly in my life. It's easier to get distant when things start going really well, you know? And so staying in the middle of AA is just so valuable for me. And so again, I appreciate it, Phil. And yes, my home group is the Hermosa Beach Men's Stag. That's where our, mutual friend Bill is from and a few others. My sponsor, Matthew M, is also from there and a few other guys. And, I grew up with those guys. Those guys really, since I was 19, those have been the people I've just been trudging with. And my home group away from my home group is the, Manhattan Beach 11 step meeting. And so if anyone's ever in Manhattan Beach, we do some meditation there on Thursday nights and at this little church by a little fireplace. It's very nice. So if anyone's in Manhattan Beach, look me up, let me know. And as far as it goes, it's very easy to talk for 48 minutes about what it was like and then 2 minutes of the steps, you know? And so I'm going to probably shortcut some of that, if that's okay. Not all of it, but some, because there's some things I really want to talk about, you know, in my life. But the way it went for me was when I was 9 months old, my parents got divorced. And my dad just kind of disappeared. He went to Arizona. And so I saw him a couple times in my life, you know, pretty early elementary school. And then it was one of those situations where on my birthday, you'd get like a call and a phone, like a phone call and maybe a little card, maybe a little check for, you know, $13 or whatever. And then as the years went on, it was like card that just said, love dad. No phone call. And then eventually the phone calls, the cards, all that stuff kind of stopped. And I was so young, I didn't really think too much of it. But that was it. There was no contact after that. And so, and it didn't hit me until maybe I got into, you know, middle school, coming into high school. I just really started to have this nagging feeling. It was kind of a pit in my stomach. And what the feeling was I grew up with a mom and two older sisters and me, and there's no males in the house. And so the feeling I had was that maybe there's you know, too much estrogen, not enough testosterone in the household, right? And that I'm just damaged goods as a result, you know? And the feeling was when I would go to school or I would be with people, there was this feeling that everybody knew exactly who they were and like who they were supposed to be and how they were supposed to act and, how, you know, what their niche was within their life. And I just had a feeling like I just didn't get that memo. You know, I missed class that day. And so I started to equate this idea that, like, because I didn't have a dad, it takes a man and a woman to come together to raise a normal functioning person. And because I was missing the dad thing, I'm missing something, you know, and I'm just going to have to figure it out. That was the feeling. And so when it was time to get sober and coming into AAA, I mean, my dad was number one on the four step. You know, my dad was so much, that was the biggest hate I had in my life, was that guy. And I just had this feeling like he caused this, you know. if only I had a dad, I would have been fine, this idea. And the longer I've stayed in AA, I have since changed my thoughts on that. But the longer I'm in AA, the more I've met people with, you know, seemingly perfect families. I've met people with no families. I've met, you know, rich, poor. I mean, every walk of life you can imagine is an Alcoholics Anonymous. Every walk of life you can imagine. And it seems like I've met people that seemingly have no external circumstances they can point to justify, quote unquote, the alcoholism. And then on the flip side, I've met people that seemingly have every possible good reason to be an alcoholic, you know, and they're not. And so it seems to me that there is something on a deeper level than my circumstances that is producing this alcoholism, as you might say it. And what the Big Book describes is a spiritual malady. And it's that spiritual malady that has really resonated with me over the years and has really helped me account for some things I couldn't otherwise account for. But I didn't know any of that. And so I just went through my life, you know, and the one thing I found that fixed that pit in my stomach is when I found alcohol. And I knew immediately. I remember my first drink was, it was Malibu rum, you know, it's like a little bit of some real sweet foo-foo stuff, you know, and I loved it. The best way I could describe what happened was it was very much like if you ever read any spiritual literature about being they'll talk about being in the present moment. That's what happened to me, you know. Everything went, all my angst, you know, all my anxiety, all my worries, all my I'm not good enough, I'm not man enough, you know, all that was gone. I was just here. I was present. I didn't really need anything external. Once that alcohol hit me, I didn't really need anything else. If you guys wanted to party, I was happy to party. But if you weren't interested, it was fine. You know, as long as I had the supply, I was good. And there was such a seeming freedom in knowing that as long as I can get that release, I'm going to be all right. And so alcohol was really the light at the end of my tunnel. It was the feeling. And it was just that was it. And so I just pretty much dedicated my life to that. What I really think early on, there is a, I don't know exactly when, I can't pinpoint maybe when this happened, but there was a certain point where I feel like I worked this perfect third step on alcohol. If you know what I mean, it was like I surrendered my will and my life to alcohol. And I couldn't really pinpoint when that was, but there was some point where it had just settled in that come what may, good, bad, right, wrong, ugly, like me and alcohol were in it, you know? And I dedicated myself to it and I really lived true to that, throughout those years I was drinking. And, I had arrived moment. I can tell you where I peaked in my drinking. It's a pretty short story. As you can see, I drank from 13 to 19. I didn't really make it that long. I have arrived moment is I got my driver's license. I had this, I had my grandma's, 1999 Buick Regal Custom. I had just got my license, right? So I had this Buick Regal Custom, and I had this big blonde afro, you know, and I got this job at a grocery store. And this grocery store had a very large alcohol inventory. And so I kind of saw this, what you might call an entrepreneurial opportunity. which involved, you know, selling that alcohol out of my trunk to my high school friends. And when I was growing up, I grew up in Poway, California in San Diego. And when I was growing up, we could get some pretty nasty substances in Poway, but getting alcohol was extremely difficult for a 15, 16 year old kid, you know? And so me having it in my trunk, I became, very popular, as you can say. Maybe not on a personal level, but definitely on a supply level, I became pretty popular, you know? And I just remember one day driving around and I had this feeling. I was imagining how much, you know, the alcohol I had in my trunk at the time. I was envisioning it and I was driving around and I had just this feeling like, oh my God. It was Bill Wilson's I Have Arrived moment. That was my I Have Arrived moment. I thought if I could just live this for, this is all I need for the rest of my life. Like as long as I have this, I'll be okay. And when I look, the reason I share that is when I look back on that now, obviously, circumstantially, that I didn't set the bar super high at that moment. But I think what really hit me with that was what I had was this deep sense of security. It was like I knew that as long as I had that alcohol in my trunk, I had control. Like I could control the way that I was going to feel, and I could control whatever happens in my life, whatever feeling that pops up. I could play whack-a-mole with whatever's in my trunk. You know what I mean? And I just knew that, like, as long as I had that, I would be okay. That it truly was that was my safety and security. And obviously living a lifestyle of that, the legal trouble started pretty quick for me. We'll just put it that way to shortcut the situation. And the legal trouble started pretty quick. And I remember right at the end of my, senior year, a couple months before graduation, I got kicked out of my high school. And then 2 weeks later, I got fired from that that grocery store job. They caught me stealing a bottle of Goldschlager, you know, the one with the little gold flakes in it. I got all, you know, I got too big for my britches, I guess. and they let me go, and I got in some trouble there. And so it all just kind of started coming unglued, you know. And that was, I was 17, and it was just unraveling pretty quickly. And basically, what ended up happening through a series of legal troubles was I ended up in the middle of a second chance from the judge. Chance number one from the judge, and this was after a few jail trips and a few things that had gone down and a pretty nasty legal record. I was in the middle of the second chance. First chance, the judge told me, look, I'm going to give you the deal of a lifetime. You're going to go to this place for six. You're going to go to these classes for 16 weeks. You're going to stay physically sober. You're not going to mess up. And if you can do this, I'm going to make your problems go away. Just do these 16 weeks for me. That was chance number one. And with deep sincerity, I meant that, well, I'm going to take these 16 weeks and I'm just going to get my head right. I knew enough to know pretty much my whole drinking. I knew enough to know that I was not what you'd call a healthy, normal social drinker. You know, like it wasn't a huge mind blowing thing when you guys talked about alcoholism for me. I mean, it was pretty obvious that like, I mean, I, what I always felt like though was that, people who didn't drink and use like I did, I just assumed they didn't know what they were missing, you know, like they just didn't understand like, yeah, you don't know what you're missing, you know? But I knew it was an issue. And so, I knew that like this 16 weeks was a chance to reset. And so I meant it. And 7 days into that 16 weeks, I had, there's a variety of terms. You can call it a mental blank spot. you can call it the case of the efforts, you know, whatever you want to call it. I just, I drank, you know, I drank and I was like, I'll just drink once, whatever. I've been doing great. I've made it 7 days. I deserve this, you know, I've earned this. And I took a drink and it just set me off, you know. And I could not complete those 16 weeks and I end up back in front of the judge and I get one more chance. And he's like, look, man, I don't know why I'm going to do this for you, but I'm going to give you one more chance. Same deal. 16 weeks, go to the classes, don't mess it up, and I'm going to make this go away. But if you mess up this 16 weeks, I am going to be a really bad judge if you don't go to jail. You know, like I have a job to do. So, And it was the story of my life, man. I had judges, I had lawyers, I had psychologists, psychiatrists, counselors, police officers. Everybody was on Team Jeremy, stay sober. You know, my family, my friend, like everybody was on Team Jeremy. And I could not stay sober. And 3 days into that 16 weeks, I got loaded with all the sincerity I could muster. And I meant it to the core. I was like, I will white knuckle this. I don't care how miserable I am. I don't care how much my life sucks. I'm not going to drink. And I drank 3 days. And I was face to face with the ugliness of my alcoholism. And I couldn't stop. And there was one day in the middle of that, I knew I was going to jail. You probably can't tell from my rugged, manly exterior, but I'm not really like a jail guy. That's not really my niche, you know? And so I was just knew that was not going to be, I was not going to be good. I did all right the couple times I went, but it was pretty short stints. Let me tell you, I was thinking big boy, and I was 18. I was going to big boy jail, you know, I had a handful of years hanging over, and I was like, dude, I could not imagine. Basically, the point being, I could not imagine drinking, and I could not imagine another way. You know, I was stuck, man. And so in the middle of this chance, it was like 3-4 in the morning. I'm chain smoking cigarettes. I'm getting loaded as hard as I can, just trying to, you know, clear my mind, get my head straight, and figure out what I'm going to do here. And I was living at my mom's house at the time, and we had this dry erase board where you write groceries and stuff on the fridge, right? And I don't remember anything before this really or after this, but I have this image of I wrote help in all caps. I wrote help. And then I passed out, on the couch actually next to it. And then I woke up in the morning. I had forgotten that I had did that, and I walk, and then I look on the fridge, and there's help just in all cat. And that was my first step in black and white on a refrigerator, dry erase board under the groceries, help. I believe when I look back, I don't think my mind wrote help. I think my soul wrote that. Do you know what I mean? I think my soul wrote that. My mind is always trying to play the game. It always wants to play the game. But something inside me, the core of me, my conscience, my soul, my whatever you want to call it, I feel like there's like a light in me that's always trying to shine through, and I just cover it with thick layers of defect, you know, and selfishness and self-centeredness. And when I can get out of my selfishness and self-centeredness just enough, a little crack in that layering shines through. And I think there was just enough light shining through that I could write help on that dry erase board. That's what I think. And it seems to me that the grace of this higher power that I've come to find in AA, the grace of this higher power seems to come when I get out of the way. If I can get, when my personal sense of self can get far enough out of the way that I can truly be relieved of the bondage of self for a moment, this something shines through, you know? And I think whatever shined through wrote help on that dry erase board. And within a week of writing help, I was in a car driving to Los Angeles to get sober. Within 1 week, I thought it was a little too soon. I was like, maybe let's not rush any major life decisions here, you know? No one else seemed to share that sentiment. And it was a miracle, man. It was a miracle. And I forgot when I wrote help on that dry erase board, I remember I looked down and my mom had responded to it. Like classic mom. So she's like, I'm going to help you. XOXO. I was like, oh my God. You know? But there was a chink in my armor, man. There's a chink in my little ego armor. And I drive up to LA and I get into this place and they tell me it's 90 days. It's a 3-month place and I was like, great. Okay. So sign this 90-day agreement. That's what they told me. And I remember I signed the 90-day agreement. We talked for another minute and he said, look, I just want to let you know, thank you for signing that, but it truly doesn't mean anything. The 90-day agreement, because, this place is 18 months. It's a year and a half. And oh my God. I remember when he said 18 months, it was like my shoulders kind of just dropped down. And then I had this moment. I felt like I could take a breath. was like a deep, like I felt like I had a deep breath, like a lot of space, like I could really finally breathe. And I just remember, oh, thank God. The thought came, I was like, thank God. As soon as you said 18 months, I was like, oh, thank God. And I think whatever it was, that little crack that wrote help on that dry erase board finally just broke open in that moment. And I had surrendered to such a depth that from that day to this day, 12 years, I have not had a drink. And so it seems to me that whatever happened to me that day, I can only equate to some kind of spiritual experience. And I think my whole purpose in Alcoholics Anonymous, I mean everything. I mean the four step, I mean the amends, the 10 step, the prayer, meditation, the sponsoring everybody, all of the stuff that I do in Alcoholics Anonymous is to find, develop, and maintain whatever connection I got that day. November 22nd, 2009. Whatever happened to me that day, I'm trying to nurture and cultivate and develop. That's what I'm doing here. You know, and there's a lot of ways to do that. In fact, there's a lot of ways to do that in general, in the world, in life. And however, there's something about Alcoholics Anonymous for me that nothing fills my soul like Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, nothing. And I've tried all kinds of things. I'll probably maybe talk about some of them. But nothing fills my soul like Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? I was reminded of that on Monday at my home group. Nothing fills my soul like this. And I started the journey, you know? And I'm not a trailblazer. I didn't come up with this very unique, amazing, Jeremy's fantastic, wacky way to stay sober. You know? I didn't come up with that. I did the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Basically, what the book suggested, I got a sponsor and I let them kind of show me what they did. And I got a home group and they showed me the ropes and I just went through the process. And the process changed me. I mean, I'm not the guy I was when I got here. And I really do want to welcome anyone who's new or newer. I can tell you, if I felt now how I felt when I was new, I would not still be here. And I think that's so important for me. I need to remember how I felt when I came in. And it's the easiest thing to forget, you know. I get a little bit of good in my life, and my life gets so good I don't have time for AA. It's the easiest thing in the world for me to do, you know. And I did not feel very good when I got here, you know. But the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think I need to make sure I drive it home for myself, especially. The miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous is that the reprieve I've been given from alcoholism is not white knuckling it. Like truly that day, the obsession has been removed. And as long as I can keep in this spiritual condition in various ways, mostly the ways the big book suggests, if I can keep in spiritual condition, then the obsession stays at bay. Right. And because what the big book talks about, and it really hit me when I was new, because I was taught about the first step, and the first step just really struck me that, and the book said, you know, we can absolutely not stay sober on the basis of self-knowledge. This is a point we wish to emphasize and drive home, that we cannot stay sober on the basis of self-knowledge. And when I got to AA, I assumed that I would do the steps, I could learn enough about the inner workings of my life, and then in my mind, you know, and then probably drink and use like a gentleman. That was really the plan I had when I got here, you know. I thought, you know, okay, cool, I'll do 90 days. You know? Something changed, and the desire has lifted, and it has stayed lifted. And so there's the don't quit before the miracle happens concept. The miracle for me, to really be specific, the miracle for me is that position of neutrality that I've been placed in. That the book talks about, safe and protected. And it's become, if you stay sober for a little bit, that starts to become the norm. Like it seems like everything I do in my life for a while starts to normalize. And I never want to normalize the fact that the obsession has been removed. It's such a dangerous thing for me to do, you know? And so I'm just so grateful that it's removed, man. And I started the journey. And a couple things happened. One of the things I did I stayed at that whole place. I did 18 months at that place. And then after the 18 months, I moved out with some people. I got a little apartment up in Redondo Beach, which is where I am now. I got this little apartment with a couple of guys I got sober with, and I just started the journey, you know, of AA outside of the structured sober living situation. It was AA. I got into AA. If you want to go to a meeting, go to a meeting. If you don't, don't. That kind of AA, you know, which that was a whole new game for me. You know, I was forced. It was so rigid for 18 months, which I'm very grateful for. But I had to transition, and I transitioned. And one of the things I'm so grateful for was I had a sponsor at the time, and we jumped into the amends pretty quickly here. And I made a couple big amends. And one of the amends I really, really wanted to make, that grocery store, you know? And so I sat with them and we started tallying up some numbers, and I came up with a pretty hefty number. It was a decently long period. And, it was quite a bit of alcohol I got a system down and became pretty costly. And when the amends came around, you know what I mean? And so I totaled the number, and it was essentially half of my entire money, which wasn't much, but it was a lot for me, quite a bit for me. And so, I guess it wasn't much relative. It's all relative, I suppose, but it was a lot. And I had the same place that deep breath kind of came from. That same place, there was another feeling there that was kind of like it was like almost like twisting at me. And it said, that's not your money. I saw this thing the other day. It was like alcoholics, they're getting mad about giving back the money that's not theirs. Right? And that was what I was doing. I was mad about giving the money that I stole, essentially. And so I went to this grocery store, and I wrote a check, and my sponsor told me, make sure the check gets deposited into the store. That was really important. Not some guy, the store. So I go to this grocery store and I asked for the manager. I was hoping it'd be the same guy, but it had been many years, and so it wasn't. And I was like, look, you don't know me, so I'm just going to keep this really short and sweet. I used to work here when I was in high school. I stole almost every day large amounts of alcohol, and I want to make it right. He's like, oh, my God. What? And I was like, look, man, I was a terrible employee, and I stole every day, and I want to give you a check. And he's like, okay. And I was like, I handed him the check, and I was like, can you deposit this? And he looked at the check, and he looked at the amount, and he looked at me, and he looked at the amount, and he's like, look, man, I don't know who you are, and I don't know what is going on, but checks are going out today, and I can run this with them, and I think you've made this right. And it was... And I was like, well, thank you. Here's my cell phone number, and here's my email, and here's my name. If this check bounces or you have some problem, call me back and I'll write you another one. And he was like, dude, okay. Like, again, I don't know who you are, but yes, we're good. And I basically levitated out of that store. You know? Mm. 6 inches above the ground, levitated out of that store. I mean, I was, you know what it is? I don't know how much something weighs me down until I let it go. It's not like I spent every waking moment thinking about, oh, that poor grocery store, you know? And yet that was such a burden on my life. And apparently it was a burden on my life financially too. Because there's a strange thing that as you make those financial amends, they have a way of coming back in unusual ways. That's very strange. Another topic. But that happened. And the, I assumed after I make this amends, I'll be completely destitute because I'll have no more money. And, but the fear of the financial insecurity was not there. I tasted a ninth step promise from that amends, you know, it did not say that financial insecurity would not be there, which was very much present, but the fear of that financial insecurity at that time was gone. And I continued to make more amends. And then there was another one I really wanted to make. Oh, I didn't tell you this story. It's brief. And so when I was in high school, I had one time I contacted my dad. And I'll paint the picture for you real quick. It was about 2 a.m. I was about halfway done with a bottle of vodka. I had found my dad's old landline number in a book. Like, you know, you'd have like books written with people's numbers on it, you know, those things. And I found that, and there was a landline number for my dad on there. And I remember I found that book and I was in my room and, you know, the liquid courage was just running strong. And I just remember thinking, wow, now's the time to make that call, you know, 2 a.m. And so I pick up the phone and I call the number and I get the, obviously it's 2 a.m. I get the voicemail, some number in Arizona, and I get the voicemail. And I remember I just let out all the emotion I had on that voicemail. I don't remember too much of the words, but I remember the energy behind the words. And I knew that was a men's worthy energy. and I never talked to him after that. I never got a phone call. I didn't. It was just in this isolated event that happened randomly in high school. And we never talked. And I had like 5 years sober. And I had the same thing, that little. My little soul center or whatever twisting at me again. Like, it's time to make that amends. And I was like, oh, I'll never find him. I remember thinking, oh, I'll never find him. That bought me like 3 months, you know, that like let my conscience chill out for a minute, bought me like 3 months. And then it came back again, make the amends. And I was like, oh, I called my sponsor. It was Matthew. And, he helped me write a letter. Because I couldn't find, so, and what happened was I was like, oh, but I'll never find him. So I wrote out this letter of what I wanted to say. And then one day I just sat there and I was like, you know what? Maybe I should try to find him. Maybe that's a start. And within 3 minutes on Google, I found his address. 3 minutes. And I was like, man, I'm pretty sure this is him, like 99%. And so I took this letter and it said, dear dad, there were better ways that I left you this voicemail in high school. I don't know if you remember it, but there were better ways I could have expressed myself and I didn't do that. And if there's anything I can do to make that right, let me know. Here's my phone number and here's my email. Love, Jeremy. That was it. And I put that letter in this envelope I found on Google and I mailed it off. And then 4 days later, I got an email from my dad. And I hadn't spoken to my dad since I was in elementary school. I got this email from my dad. And all I saw was his name first. Like, it was on my phone. And I was pulling up the emails. And then I saw his name, just his name, the fact that he had sent me the email. And I got this overwhelming conviction feeling, this conviction that no matter what this email says, no matter how this goes, this resentment is done, you know, and no matter what this email says, like, this guy has no more power over me. All this too much estrogen, not enough testosterone stuff, all this you're not man enough, all this whatever, it's done. That was the feeling I had. And so I had so much conviction opening that email. I truly had surrendered the result. There's not that many times in my life when I really, truly surrender the results of my actions. I pay a lip service because it's a practice, but sometimes in a spiritual setting, in a certain moment, I truly surrender the result. And this was one of those moments. And I opened the email and said, Jeremy, I was really surprised to receive your letter. I do remember the voicemail. It's of course no problem. I still love you and your sisters, and I just wish things could have been different, Dad. And that was it. And I was free. You know, I was free. I didn't need anything from him. And I saw so clearly that, God, I just saw it. That guy was doing the best he could with what he got, with what he has at that moment. And this is what he has, you know? When I was getting loaded, I was doing the best I could with what I had at that moment. That was my level of development at that time, I suppose. That was my lack of spiritual connection only allowed me to go so far when I was getting loaded. My overwhelming self-centeredness only allowed me to go so far. And that's where he's at. I don't know if he's an alcoholic. I don't know if he's just whatever you want to call it. There's a malady of some sort there. And I just no longer hated him. And so the forgiveness like happened to me. It wasn't intellectually. I'd told myself a million times I forgave him. After the fourth step, I told myself I forgave him. But the journey from the head to the heart takes a little longer than that, you know? And I find truly my whole thing, and I learned pretty much everything intellectually I was going to learn in AA, probably in the first 2 years, intellectually. And so what my whole process has been over these years is to take that intellectual knowledge and have it mature into my reality, into who I am, into wisdom. You know, it's the journey from the head to the heart, and it's the process of the steps that matures that journey, I think. excuse me. It was heavy. It was very heavy. And now I am the father of a 7-month-old baby. And I have the opportunity, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, to be the father that I did not have growing up, right? I mean, what a miracle. Like, if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, this thing is not about just being physically sober. Just being physically sober was just a prerequisite. It's like, that's just getting things rolling. That was like the introductory course. You know what I mean? Truly, the spiritual development that's available through the steps of AA, I mean, it's a serious spiritual path to walk, you know, and I'm so grateful I get to walk it. And I'm actually, ironically, I'm in this hotel room. It's right across the street from Disneyland, and which is where my wife and my baby are. And it's so cool. It's so cool it's like the perfect day for me. I'm just going to take a second to tell you about the perfect day for me, because we live pretty close. I'm in Redondo Beach, which is like 40 minutes from Disneyland. And my wife got free tickets from her work. Right. So we woke up early. We got the baby ready. And so instead of we were like, let's make it a thing, you know, and get a hotel room across the street. Because, I mean, we have a 7-month-old baby. It's not exactly like the perfect thing for Disneyland. So we got this hotel room so we could like kind of go chill out, and then we got this, and then the speaking thing came, and I was like, perfect. And so I'm going to take this time and speak. And so we got to bring the baby to Disneyland, have this family day, and then kind of the way I can recalibrate after the sensory overload that is Disneyland with the 7-month-old is I get to come here and I get to speak with you guys. You know, and then right after this is done, I get to hop out and then go meet them back at the park right there. And I don't know about you, but for me, a guy like me, I could not appreciate a simple joy like that in my life when I was getting loaded. You know, I couldn't feel it. The love would be around me. The room would be full of love, and I just could not connect to it. And I think when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, what I'm really looking for is connection. That's really what I want. It's connection. And I feel it. And even over Zoom, I feel it, you know. And honestly, it was really nice just coming in here and hanging out and then just watching you guys start this thing. You know, I love that. I love that when I get to speak on Zoom and I when there's a really active group and everybody knows each other and they're talking. And, you know, I mean, I just love that. It's like the meeting. It's the meeting before the meeting. Truly, it is, you know. I just, it's beautiful. Thank you. So I just wanted to share that. And on the topic of unburdening, which is, I think, my whole process here, what I'm after in Alcoholics Anonymous is this conscious contact with a higher power. And in fact, the big book, it really, the whole, what it was laid out to me and what I saw in the readings was the whole point of this book is to help you find a spiritual connection that can solve your problem, a higher power that can solve your problem. That's the point. Not that you can get a bunch of self-knowledge and then solve your own problem. It was surrender to a higher power that can help you solve your problem. But at the same time, it just felt so vague. Like, what is this? Like, this conscious contact felt so vague to me. And in fact, in step 11, it says it's easy to be vague about this matter. You know, we have some definite and valuable suggestions, but it's very easy to be vague about the prayer and meditation, about conscious contact. They have an appendix about the spiritual experience just because there's so much about it. And I can tell you one of the best ways it happens for me. This is one of the ways I connect. This is one of my identifiers. And maybe it's helpful. There's something that happens to me when I go to a meeting, pretty much any meeting, I would say. We'll put it this way. Yeah, pretty much any meeting. If I go, I go to the meeting. No matter what's going on in my life leading up to that meeting, good, bad, whatever, mostly bad. Those things tend to be what I carry into a meeting, you know. I bring that stuff in and I'm in the meeting and we go through the process and then I get in the car. And if there's something that happens to me that I can tune into when I get in the car and I get to the steering wheel and I get this feeling, I don't know if you guys know this feeling, that I, no matter what was going on in my life leading up to that meeting, it is wiped. For this evening, like, it's wiped, you know, it's there. It all exists. The circumstances of my life are all the same and yet I'm free. You know what I'm talking about? That feeling to me, that to me is the conscious contact. That's it. And there's greater and greater degrees of it, but that's it. That is the surrender. That is the unburdening. That is the freedom from the bondage of self for me. I feel it, man. I feel it. But there was a thing I noticed, which was that doesn't always happen. And I had this, why, you know, why? And sometimes I would pray and I would feel it. Same kind of unburdening, a deep, real, sincere prayer. I would feel it. And then sometimes not. I was like, why, you know, and I have an 11-step practice, same thing. And I've been studying all kinds of different things spiritually, extracurricular spirituality, if you want to call it that, over the years. And this is what resonates with me. A meditation teacher has taught me. In his tradition, there's the translation of his tradition, the way you would put it in English is we were talking about what is spiritual, what makes something spiritual. And he said, a spirited ritual is spiritual. A spirited ritual is spiritual. It's not the ritual. It's the spirit that I bring to the ritual. That's what makes it spiritual. It's not being in the meeting. It's what I bring to the meeting. That's what makes it spiritual in my life. I was told when I was new that you can't get this thing from osmosis. You don't sit in a meeting and absorb it, you know? And it seems to me that the grace of a higher power isn't something out there somewhere that I grab and I pull into my life. It's something already here, and I need to open out a way to express it. And the best way that I've found to express it in my life is Alcoholics Anonymous. For me, at least in my life, there's no better way. And when I bring the right spirit to a meeting, I'm free. You know, when I bring the right spirit to a sponsee, when I bring the right spirit to the amends, the steps in general. And so one of the most spirited rituals that I do, I found, and it happens seemingly effortlessly, but one of the most spirited rituals I do is I go to meetings. The other most spirited ritual is when I meet the sponsees. Those two things, naturally, maybe it's from habit, maybe it's from doing it over the years, whatever it is, for some reason, those two things pull something out of me. Like, I wish I could be the guy that I am with the sponsee in every aspect of my life, 24 hours a day. I'm at my purest, you know, when I'm with a new guy. And why is that? I think truly it's because I don't need anything. I'm not looking for anything from him. There's no ulterior motive. It's truly the joy of participation when I'm with him, you know? And I believe that the pinnacle of my spiritual development is when I can bring that same spirit to every single aspect of my life, regardless of how I label it. Oh, this is wholesome. This is not. This is spiritual. This is not. If I can bring that same energy, that would be amazing. So far, seems like AA is taking the cake for my spirited rituals. Work, I'm getting there, you know, and being with this baby frees me up. And this is the last thing I want to share. sorry, my throat got a little messed up from the dad thing. I got a little... this is the last thing. When about 3 weeks ago, we spent 5 days in the hospital with my 7-month-old. Say he was 6 months. 5 days in the hospital. He had something called RSV, which apparently some people know about that. But it's a flu kind of situation, and it creates this really nasty, sticky mucus that can block. If the baby's too young, it can block their breathing. And we were noticing some of this. He had tested positive for it. Sometimes it's nothing. Sometimes it's mild, whatever. So we were keeping our eye on it, and we noticed the breathing was a little bit, nothing dire, but it was getting, like, not perfect. And so we took him to the emergency room thinking they'd give a little, here's a little something, here's and this and that. You can go home. And we went on Friday, and then they admitted us. And then we were there Saturday, we were there Sunday, we were there Monday, and we finally got to go out on a Tuesday. And the first day or two, that had to be some of the gnarliest emotion in my life. The fear, the uncertainty, the powerlessness. Oh my God, the powerlessness. Of that feeling. I mean, there's nothing I can do, you know? And in my 11-step world, it just really brought it home, because my tendency, my go-to is, you know, thy will be done is great, assuming everything's going my way, you know? Like when everything's on track, I will be done, man. I could do this God thing all day long. And the big book poses a question. The 12 and 12 poses a question about prayer. Were we not asking God to do our will? Because my first thought was, God, fix this. I don't know if you're playing golf, you're on vacation, you're doing whatever. But, like, you've been pretty good up to this point. Lately, I feel like you've been on a hot streak, you know? But, like, you kind of blew this one. So, like, God, you know, go ahead and take care of that. Now, that is not my concept of prayer. Truly, it's not. And yet, initially, that's where my mind goes, always. Foxhole. Fix this. You know, that kind of thing. And that was my first thing. And then what came into my mind was that question from the step 11 in the 12 and 12 was, were we asking God to do our will? And I was saying, God, fix this. My will, I know exactly what needs to be done. And if I can't do it physically and I can't do it mentally, damn it, I'm going to try it spiritually. God, fix it. And in my experience, that has not worked. What worked was this. The other question the big book poses, kind of a statement. God is or he isn't. What's our choice? God is or he isn't. What's our choice? And by me saying God fix this, I'm saying he isn't, and I need to make him be. And so in that moment, he isn't. And I was like, you know what? God is. And if God is, truly, if God is, then I need to let this go. And I need to, and if I let this go, what does that mean for me? And what it meant for me is that I could show up for this moment. I could show up for this situation, despite the feelings, despite the fear, you know, not get rid of the feelings, not get rid of the fear, but despite them, I could show up and I can be there and I can do the next indicated action to the best of my ability. And I could bring the spirit to it. I can only do that through that surrender. I can't do that with my strain and my anxiety and my fear. I can do that through the surrender. And it was that got me through that 5 days. And he came out the other side and he's good. And we're at Disneyland and it's beautiful. And so what it is for me is my whole thing in Alcoholics Anonymous is that I am trying to remember that God is. And the way that I remember that God is through the steps and through my connection with you guys. I tell myself God is intellectually, and then I'm using AA to make that journey from the head to the heart so that I can experience that God is. And it's that experience that allows me the spiritual recovery. It's that experience that allows me the reprieve contingent on that spiritual maintenance. And so with that, I love you all. Thank you so much.